Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, a national liberal arts college and conservatory, offering an engaging global education with funding for internships, research, study abroad, and more. Lawrence.edu.
Support for WPR comes from Stafford Rosenbaum, a Wisconsin-based law firm celebrating 145 years of commitment to practical legal solutions in areas such as family law and estate planning. StaffordLaw.com.
Well, millions and millions, maybe billions of dollars came out of the world's stock markets a few days ago. The money just didn't evaporate. I may be trying to decide where to alight. We'll talk about that a little bit and talk about your investments and how you can invest for retirement with Frank Armstrong of Coconut Grove, Florida. He's been one of our regular guests here. He's a very popular guest. He's founder of the investment advisor firm Investor Solutions, Inc., and is author of the book The Informed Investor. It's published by Amicon. Always a treat to have him on. And certainly if you have questions for him as we move along today, feel free to join in with your investment questions at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call. Frank Armstrong with us by phone. Frank, hi. Thanks for taking time to be with us once again.
Always a pleasure, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. Well, the stock market took a little dip here in the last few weeks, in the last week, I guess it is now. Concern on your part?
No. I mean, nobody was concerned when it was up. The only concern, you know, it's supposed to go both ways. It's got to adjust. You can't just have it go straight up. So, you know, we've had several years of really great markets, and a 3%, 4% reduction is something that investors really ought to take in stride. If their asset allocation is right, that is, if they got enough liquid assets to get through the next few years from their investment pool, then it ought to be a non-event. If they don't, then perhaps they ought to be thinking about their asset allocation. Otherwise, they ought to go back and take care of their grandkids or their kids.
Well, it seems like things have kind of settled down again, haven't they?
Well, they did. You know, a little ripple went around the world, and then it settled down. The prices are still, in most cases, above where they were at the beginning of the year. If you'd gone to sleep on December 31st and woke up yesterday and seen the change, you'd go, hum, and gone on to find something else.
Yeah, I think I would agree with you. Alan Greenspan, who was obviously the former Federal Reserve Chairman, made a comment that it's possible we can get a recession in the latter months of 2007. You know, do economists have a good track record of forecasting those kinds of things?
It's ridiculous to think about. I mean, if they had a good record, then you and I could just sell a few options and sail away. I mean, you know, they're all just speculating like the rest of us, and a few billion of your closest friends are speculating every day whether the market's going to go up or down, and so they either buy or sell stocks, and that's what sets price levels.
Yeah. If you're an investor and you want to lessen your risks in stocks and maybe move into bonds, are bonds still a safe bet?
Depends on what bonds. Long-term treasuries have always been kind of risky. They go up and down as much as the S&P 500, but they only return about a third as much. You and I are individual investors. We ought probably not to be out that long in a 30-year bond. But if you're talking about high-quality short-term bonds, then yeah, they're very safe. But there's places in the bond market that have a lot of risk, the junk bonds. And now these mortgage-backed securities that are of junk bond quality may see some pressure. But we never go there, so we don't care.
Yeah. 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. Well, where do we go then if we don't go there?
Well, if you're talking about if you are concerned that you don't have enough liquid assets or your asset allocation is too aggressive, then the short-term high-quality bond funds like Vanguard's or Dimensional Fund Advisors that we use or some other very high-quality short-term bond fund is rock solid. But the question you really ought to be asking yourself is, what should my long-term asset allocation be? How much liquidity do I need? how badly will I sleep if the market goes down and I don't have enough liquidity? And once you solve those, you ought to not be thinking on a day-to-day basis.
So how do we go through that process of deciding?
Well, the first step is determine what your financial situation is today. Take a little inventory of what assets you have. Then think about what your goals are for tomorrow. When do you want to retire? What about college education for the kids? How about buying that sailboat? All those things, you put a dollar value on those. Then you see what the difference is, and you see what the time is. You can back off and see what you've got to save or if you've got enough to get to those things. And then, depending on your time horizon, you can start to build an asset allocation that makes sense. Clearly, if tomorrow is the day you're going to retire, you ought not to be 100% in the stock market.
Yeah.
Or if tomorrow is the day you're going to buy that sailboat, you ought to have enough funds to buy it in rock solid, because you don't want to make your sailboat purchase dependent on what the stock market did yesterday. You should have those liquid assets salted away.
Yeah.
But, you know, you need to survive. Most of us need to be looking at how are we going to generate income for the rest of our lives, which for many of you are a 40, 50-year time horizon. Some part of that money needs to be put away to grow much more than inflation, and it's got to be invested at some degree of risk, and you've got to tolerate that risk or you're not going to get where you want to be.
Yeah. Well, as we look at risk and so forth, I've seen where some analysts are advising cutting, trimming holdings in developing nations and moving the money into large cap U.S. stocks. What are your thoughts on that?
I go back to my previous statement.
Yeah.
I mean, we have about 11 different asset classes that we have a fixed allocation to in the equities market. I think it's really kind of useless to be thinking about whether developed markets are going to do better than emerging markets or the U.S. market, et cetera, because that's not the kind of discussion you should be having with yourself every 30 seconds. You do have an opportunity, if you buy these different asset classes once a year, say, to look at them and see which have done really well and which have done poorly, and to rebalance your asset allocation back to your original target if it's still appropriate. And by systematically doing that, you force yourself to sell high, buy low, which is what we're supposed to be doing, remember.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good idea. And actually, you will increase your rate of return by systematically rebalancing. And if the assets are volatile, you might increase the rate of return by up to a 0.5% per year, which over your lifetime is a lot.
A lot of money. Frank Armstrong, our guest today, founder of the investment advisor firm Investor Solutions and author of the book The Informed Investor. It's published by Amicon. Glad to have him along, and certainly give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in Madison, call us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Sort of, this isn't, in some ways it's a stock question, I guess, or an investment question, but the field of home loans, I'm reading now that we're seeing some real problems. People went in with weak credit, and we're seeing more defaults on home loans.
Yes, you are. And the banks, this is a show called Banks Gone Crazy. They never learn their lesson. In order to put all these loans out, in some cases, they made loans to people and didn't verify their income or any of the other information about them. They call them liar's loans. They just, you could say you made $100,000 and you wanted a $200,000 mortgage, and they'd say, sign here and give you the money. Well, if you relax your standards to that far, then sooner or later you're going to get burned. In other cases, people bought into loans that were teaser loans in the beginning, extraordinarily low interest rates, but now they're adjusting upwards and they find they can't afford the mortgage. And so there's going to be some pain there, and we're starting to see houses get foreclosed on, and a lot of loans that are those loans get packaged up and sold as securities. And those securities are systematically being downgraded to junk bond status in some cases. And when they do, the institutions that hold them may have to sell them, which would require a further market adjustment. And so, yeah, it may be kind of trashy, but again, individual investors probably ought not to be in that part of the market.
Yeah.
They really don't need to take that risk with their safe dollars.
Yeah.
If they're going to take a risk, they ought to invest someplace where more than likely it's going to have a reasonable rate of return. And bonds are not it. Bonds are appropriate for long-term pensions or for insurance companies, you know, who need to match assets to liabilities, but not necessarily to you and I, who need to maximize our rate of return per unit of risk.
Let's go to the phones. Chris in Algoma, it's your turn. Chris, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Frank and Larry. Listen, I was wondering, what would you do, Frank, if, say, you were going to sell your real estate assets at about $750,000 of profit and just sell everything and retire? What would you do with that money? What would the capital gain implications be?
Well, typically, unless you've depreciated the real estate, you know, like an apartment building, the capital gains are at the 15% rate. If it's your home, you get, a $500,000 one-time adjustment, and that's nice. But if it's your home, then you have to think, where am I going to live for the rest of my life? Because you need to set aside some money to buy another one. But, you know, if it's the appropriate time to sell your real estate and the appropriate time to retire, then I think you need to sit down with a blank sheet of paper, decide what you want to do when you grow up, how much money you need, and develop a financial plan that gets you to where you want to be. And I don't think you and I can do that on 30 seconds on the radio.
Yeah. But it takes, and maybe sitting down with an investment advisor.
Right, but you know, first of all, I think you ought to sit down with your bride if you're married, across the kitchen table, and decide what kind of lifestyle you want to live, where you want to live, how much income it's going to need, and then I think having done a little bit of that homework, an investment advisor can help you a great deal quicker. Otherwise, if you came into my office, I'd send you back to do that homework.
Yeah.
I can't tell you, I can't make a plan out of nothing, and no other investment advisor can either.
Yeah. Frank Armstrong, our guest today as we talk investing for retirement with him. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking strategic investing for retirement today with Frank Armstrong, founder of the investment advisor firm Investor Solutions, Inc., and author of The Informed Investor, published by Amicon. My cold is still affecting my voice as well as my brain once in a while here. Glad to have you listening in. And certainly, if you'd like to join us with a question of your own, we have an open line or two. We can get you on pretty fast at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. And let's go back to the phones. Deborah in West Bend will give you a chance now. Deborah, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I would like to know if somebody such as yourself can give me some verification of the real headline inflation rates that we have been experiencing individually per year from 2000 through 2006, the real inflation rate, not the lies we're hearing, and the trend that you're expecting in 2007, and your opinion would be appreciated.
Okay. Frank?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. I think that the government slightly underreports inflation, but it's a very tricky problem because you have to account for products that didn't even exist in the past that become now items that we think we have to have. If you take a look at your cable bill, for instance, it's significant. And 10 years ago, nobody had one. We all got our TV from the airwaves. So how do you account for that in inflation? I feel some sympathy for the people who make up those numbers. On the other hand, I do think that the cost of living is probably underreported. How much? I don't know, but I think it's it's not a trivial amount that it's underreported. On the other hand, you know, it's going to be a fact of life. Government policy is to keep inflation in the neighborhood of 3%. Otherwise, capitalism doesn't work very well because nobody will buy anything if they think the prices tomorrow are going to be lower than they are today. And nobody will borrow money and you know, there's or lend money. There's a lot of problems if we don't have modest amounts of inflation. But I really can't peg the amount that true inflation is. I have my own gut feelings about it, but it's hardly scientific. It may not be nearly as accurate as yours.
Yeah. All right. All right. Thanks, Deb. Tom in Fitchburg, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hello. I'm on total disability. I used to have a good job, and I had a lot saved up for retirement, but I'd be much better off if I had medical assistance. And in order to do that, I can't have $2,000 worth of assets other than my house. Hmm. What do I do?
I'm afraid I'm not a Medicaid or a Medicare expert. If you're on total disability, you should qualify for Medicare, I believe. But I'm really not an authoritative source on that. I'd be beyond my comfort zone to help you on that.
Sorry, Tom, we can't help you on this one. We have other shows that deal with that, and I hope you'll stay listening. Sue and Bloomer, it's your turn next. Hello, Sue.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks for calling.
Great. My question has to do with 401Ks, 403Bs versus Roths. My husband and I are single, dual income, mid-40s, are contributing quite a bit to our 401K, 403Bs. Wondering if we should continue to put more into those up to the maximum limits or start considering Roth IRAs, and didn't know if you had some good guidelines of why do one over the other.
Okay.
Well, the nice thing about a Roth IRA is that if you think tax rates are going to go up after you retire, and many of us wouldn't discount that possibility,
then
you're better off with a Roth. If you think they're going to stay the same, it's really a matter of indifference to you. If you think they're going down, then the ability to take a deduction at the highest rate today and pay it back later at a lower rate is the way you want to go. So you want to do the traditional. A lot of advisors are suggesting that people split the difference because we really don't know. And that one thing about a Roth is it's better for your estate planning. And so if that's a concern, then go a little bit to the Roth. The other thing that's nice about it is that when you reach age 70 and a half, you don't have to take any money out of that Roth.
Okay.
You can leave it grow forever if you like, and then your kids will get it up later. So, and they'll never pay income tax on it.
Okay.
So there are some nice things about the Roth, but the primary consideration is what do you think happens to tax rates for most people?
Well, that's the question. I mean, from what we're reading and understanding, is actually it seems like as people are getting into retirement now, their tax rates are almost don't seem to be any better is what we're hearing anyway, that they're not.
Well, they're probably not for many people, especially for successful people. But the question is, suppose the government raises the rates later, then you will be really happy if you have some money salted away in a Roth. And many of us wouldn't preclude that possibility. I don't want to make predictions as to what the government could or might do, because you know what those guys in Washington do. I think sometimes they're on another planet entirely from the rest of
us. I would agree with that.
But you know, to hedge that possibility, you could split the money into Roth and regular.
Okay, and is there an easy way to kind of figure out what your tax savings would be? Your current income tax savings if you did more with a 401k versus a Roth?
Just take your top marginal tax rate and multiply it by the amount of additional contributions, and that'll tell you what you're going to save in taxes.
Okay.
All right.
Great.
So for instance, let's say you're in a 32% bracket. You're a high income earner, and you put another $1,000 in. Well, you save $320 in taxes.
Okay. Sounds great.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And John and Hilbert, your turn. Hi, John.
Hello, Larry and Frank. My question concerns the stock market and how it dropped so abruptly here recently. And you kind of mentioned it a little bit at the beginning of the show, Larry.
Yeah.
What happens to those billions or more of money? It doesn't just evaporate. What happens to it?
Well, actually, in a sense, it does. Suppose you thought your neighbor told you your house was worth $2 million. Okay, so now you mentally you think you're worth $2 million. You got no other assets. But then you go to sell it and you only get $1 million. Did money actually evaporate, or did it just sort of evaporate from your head? And if you think your price of your stock is worth $64 and now it's only worth $32, did money actually have to evaporate for that to happen? No. But when we count up what the value of the world's assets are, there is a change. So it didn't go into a drawer someplace. It just got adjusted to maybe a more realistic number. And why the stock market went down? Well, you know, a lot of people have thoughts about remarks that the former chairman of the Fed made, stock market. And the Chinese stock market is very small compared to ours. I think the number's about 5%. But it's also heavily played with by the Chinese government. They invest to keep prices up and encourage people. They haven't quite decided what free markets mean over there yet. And there was a rumor floating around that they were going to impose a capital gains tax or something like that. Evidently, it wasn't even true, but the market had gone up 135% the previous year, so a 9% drop doesn't shock me.
Yeah.
So markets got to go down every once in a while. And if you focus on that one-week period when it went down and forget about the 400 years when it's gone up, you're missing the train.
Yeah. Makes sense. Okay, John, thanks.
Makes me feel much better, though.
All right.
It's all profit-taking.
No, not all of it, John.
No, it didn't go into a drawer. I mean, I think that's a sort of a common misconception, that if it goes down, somebody made a lot of money and they took it away from you. It's not necessarily true. It just got reevaluated.
Jim and Stevens Point, hello to you.
Hi, I'm fine. And yourself?
Moving along here, how can we help you?
Okay, I have just retired, and over the years we perhaps haven't been as wise as we might have been. We've had investments, I inherited an IRA and mandatory disbursement, and I had a 403B from work with one investment agency, and I had personal investments with another company, and we're going to consolidate with a single firm or management, you know. The question is it wiser for someone who's retired and probably not going to be heavily active in trading to go with a plan in which you pay, you know, commissions when you do make a move, or to pay someone an annual percentage on the gross, say, roughly in the range of 1%?
I have a huge conflict of interest to answer that, because we're paid by a fee depending on the assets under management. And it scales from 1% down, but I think if you're going to get financial advice, you have to decide where the highest probability that you're going to get professional quality advice and objective advice is. And my feeling, even though I have a conflict of interest on this that's very real, is that you're better served to use someone who's totally objective and where commissions are not the issue for either side. Because let's say I was a stockbroker, and you came to me and you had $100,000 and you said, Frank, I want something that's safe. Well, one choice is a treasury bill. Very safe, but I'm going to make $25. Another choice is an annuity. Safe in some terms, but I'm going to make a 12% commission. Well, which do you think I like? The $12,000? Or the $25. So that kind of a conflict of interest clouds the entire advice in a commission-based environment. I don't think it's possible to guarantee yourself that you're ever getting conflict-free advice in that environment.
I think you said pretty much the way I feel, because if you go to the plan you're talking about, the advisor has a vested interest in making your, let's call it, nest egg grow, because obviously he'll get a bigger slice of a bigger pie, and it's in his best interest to help you, you know, increase the value of that asset.
Well, that's true, and also we want to keep you as a client, and so the service level would better be pretty high, because we know we got a lot of competitors.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to evaluate that for yourself. There's, the SEC has got some guidelines about how to choose an advisor. The Financial Planning Association does, NAPFA does. But in my heart, I'm where I am because I think that's the appropriate way to give advice.
Mm.
When you sit down with me, you know that at least, I may be stupid, but at least you know that I'm not calculating a way that if I give you one piece of advice, I make more than if I give you another.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim. Thanks a lot for calling. Dan in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Larry. I appreciate you taking the call. I've got two questions, and I'll take the answer off the air. The first one was from the last caller mentioned 403B plans. If you're a government state employee and you're also eligible for this deferred comp program, it's my understanding that you can do the 15-5 of set-aside in the 403 and in the state deferred comp program. Is that in fact true or not? And then my second question is, you hear so much about asset allocation, I'm curious how your guests decides to pick the asset allocation for the investor, knowing that with what just happened with overseas stocks, there's a lot of discussion about how much of the world economy is in the U.S., but based on Enron situation, invest overseas, not here, and how should an individual pick that base asset allocation that they work with? And I'll listen for your responses. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Okay, first, I believe you can do both contributions if you're a state employee or federal employee. But I'm not an expert on those. I believe you can do both. Second, our asset allocation guidelines start with the world economy. The ideal portfolio from both an academic and from real-world experience is if you could own your own little share of every traded stock in the world. And on a capitalization-weighted basis. In other words, General Motors is obviously worth more than the corner gas station, et cetera. So we take a look at cap weightings, and then the next thought is that there's a lot of good evidence that suggests that small companies and value companies have higher rates of return and can be mixed together into a portfolio that doesn't have any higher risk. So we buy the whole world's economy, or that portion of it that we can freely buy, and then we go back and buy more small and value stocks. And then we say to ourselves, well, real estate's a big asset class, and it doesn't behave nearly like the stock market does, so we get good diversification there. And then finally, we look at commodity futures, which almost never does what the stock market does, so we get a chance to reduce the risk at the portfolio level. And by the time we've done that, we've got about 11 asset classes. And then I would love to tell you that we scientifically weight exactly how much to the hundredth of a percent we should have in each. But unfortunately, I'm going to tell you a little secret. To a large extent, it's arbitrary. It's kind of like a cook making soup. You know, they put a little salt in. So there are some general guidelines, but intelligent people will certainly disagree and can disagree about how much you want to overweight small and how much you want to overweight value. As to the question of how much outside the United States, we're pretty much 50-50 because that ideally hedges the value of the dollar. And so if you lose a dollar or if you lose a percent in value here with the currency, but you own a share of stock on the French exchange, say, and that exchange goes up 1% because of the value of the dollar, then you've made some money, even if the local exchange didn't move a bit. So if you lose money here locally, you can make it up because the foreign markets are increased in their value because of the dollar weighting or the dollar. So it ideally hedges that. So we're at 50-50 there. I hope that's been helpful. Those are guidelines.
Yeah.
But again, you can sit down. We'll meet at a bar someplace 50 years from now and decide what the really best asset allocation would have been. But, of course, that'll tell us nothing about what to do for the next 50 years.
Thanks, Dan, for calling. Stephen Madison, hello.
Good morning. I have another question about the Roth, but this is about a conversion from a regular IRA to a Roth. What do you think about doing that? If you have some money that you don't think you're going to have to, you know, use for the next 15 or 20 years.
Okay, we've done some very large Roth conversions for clients who do it for estate planning needs. And I think that's the most compelling reason. If you have more money than you think you want to have to be forced to withdraw at 70 and a half, you could consider changing now. Because you won't be forced to withdraw. But remember, you've got to make the upfront tax payment now, and that depletes some of your working capital. So the big consideration is, for people who aren't doing it for estate planning purposes, what are tax rates going to be in the future versus what am I paying today? Or what would I pay on the conversion? Because when you do a large conversion, that moves your tax rate.
Yeah. Things to think about, Steve. Matt in Madison, your turn. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thank you. I'm 25 years old, self-employed. What I was wanting to know is, do you have any advice for somebody? I've been putting into a Roth IRA for about the last 5 years. What do you recommend for somebody who's just getting started and trying to look ahead to when they do retire? What's the best? I hear people say, well, you can start out and going with aggressive stocks when you're young and then go safer as you get older. But I don't know. I've always been kind of nervous about playing the stock market in general. So didn't know what you had as far as advice for someone in my situation.
Well, first of all, the money that you're investing in your retirement accounts, it at your age, you're not going to take it out for 35, 40 years. And you have every reason to expect that if you'll just grin and bear it as the market goes up and down, you'll be far, far better off to have taken the risk and endured the market fluctuations. Having said that, I want to make sure that you understand that since you are self-employed, you need to have enough money on the side so that you can deal with the normal business emergencies without having to tap your IRA, or if you have a period where you can't work, you have insurance for that. So you need to have a healthy reserve on the outside before you get too aggressive. And remember, you don't want to be tapping the IRA because you'll have to pay all kinds of taxes to take the money out prior to age 59 and a half, unless you're totally disabled, and you don't want to be that.
No, I certainly don't want to be that.
The other thing I'd like to tell you, though, is that self-employed can do a regular profit sharing or pension plan, and you can contribute up to 25% of your retirement if your cash flow allows you to do that. So self-employed can take the same kind of retirement plans that anybody else in the world can now, and you're not capped at whatever the IRA limit is for the year if you can afford to contribute more than any of the discount brokerage houses will allow you to sign very simple documents that allow you to take the higher limits.
Okay.
And you're a smart guy for thinking about this now at 25 years of age.
That's right. You'll be very happy to have done that. But I also think the highest probability chance is you'll be very happy to endure some market risk, manage it effectively, do global diversification and those kinds of issues so you don't get walloped in one small part of the market. But you'll be very happy that you took that risk, I think, when you look back at it 30 years from now.
Yep.
All righty. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. Yeah, you'd like to – you'd probably, Frank, like to see a higher percentage of your people coming to see you at that age as opposed to much, much older.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the earlier you start, the easier it is. Just imagine that you've got to push a ball up the hill. If you start way out in front of that hill, then the grade isn't very steep. But if you wait until you're right up next to it, that grade is awfully steep. And at some point, it becomes too steep for you to roll. And that's the same with retirement. If you wait too long to start, you're never going to meet your objectives. Yeah. And it won't matter how smart your investment advisor is. If you don't invest enough and have the discipline to actually put the money in, it's not going to be there.
Frank, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure for me too, Larry.
Yep, thanks. And your website address again is?
InvestorSolutions.com. And any of your listeners are more than welcome to sign up for our newsletter. It comes out about twice a month, and it's investment-related topics and tax topics. And several thousand people enjoy it, and we hope some of your listeners will too.
Thank you, Frank. Frank Armstrong, who is founder of the investment advisor firm Investor Solutions, Inc. Thanks to him. Thanks to you for listening.